You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 143 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Episode 143. I was going to say, has there ever been a notable 43 in Seattle sports history?
Well, it's weird because of the fact that I was thinking of one that's jumped out to me, and then I remembered Jack Sikma was 43 and is retired.
Was so. It Heathcliff Slocum was the first one or something?
Jeff Nelson.
Jeff Nelson.
Also, shouts to Ashley Robinson, longtime Storm Center.
No, number 43. Wow, you really came up with a lot of those. This is your skill.
There was a question on the back-to-back Friday mailbag last week. What are you embarrassingly good at? I think you know the answer.
Remembering sporting events from 20 plus years ago?
No, actually, the actual answer is, I've talked to you about this. I don't know if we ever mentioned on the podcast. When a penalty is called in the NFL and they identify the player by number, I am shockingly, embarrassingly good at knowing which offensive lineman it is that got called for holding.
For every team?
Yes. I have no idea where...
You're that good at that? To me, because if you take a person who's like an NFL expert, like Robert Mays or something, right? He's going to know most of those players.
I don't know if they necessarily will by jersey number, but
you are
I'm
much
not,
better at remembering Seattle sporting events from the 90s.
But it makes sense that I'm good at that. It doesn't make sense that I know what Andres Pete's jersey number is.
You came up with a pretty random one during the NFC Championship, one of the championship games.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, wow, I've never even heard of this person. That was a defensive player, too. My favorite thing is when in Super Mario World, when you hit the pole at the end, getting a number, right? If you hit it, it gives you a number that adds up, and then saying which Seattle sports player also wears that number. And the time that we were playing Super Mario World was mostly the mid-90s, and so they're all like Sonics from the mid-90s and various Mariners from the mid-90s, right? Never Seahawks players, because we paid no attention to the Seahawks at the time. Also, the numbers, I think, were quite a bit higher, because it only goes up to like 40.
Sure.
And I could not tell you who even the quarterback was of the Seahawks in 1993.
Rick Meyer was the quarterback of the Seahawks.
I guess that's... But
it's pretty notable.
I've passed that along now to all of the baby fantasy geniuses.
Even the babiest fantasy genius at age two?
He's getting there. Shockingly good at it.
Oh.
But like Luca will be like, who's number 24, dad, or whatever? And I'm like, you know this. I'm like, I'm embarrassed that I have to tell you this. It's Desmond Mason.
Of course it is. Should we get to our beer this week?
It's an important beer because we have an important toast to get to.
That's a good point. This is one I've had in my fridge for a solid couple months now.
Okay.
Just waiting to...
At least it hasn't been in your fridge since Katie lived there.
And there's only a few beers there from that. From the Riverbend Brewing Company, we've had several of these on the podcast. But this one, I think you maybe have drank it. I have not.
I've definitely drank it before.
It's the Mango Fluff Yourself. Ooh, I gotta be careful with it when I read that. The Mango Fluff Yourself Mango Milkshake IPA. This time, real mango was used in our milkshake IPA series. Dank hops and juicy mango elope your senses. A creamy, smooth body backs up all that tropical goodness. Would you like a second? Fluff yeah.
Oh, God. It's like you wrote this copy.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have a second, so that's not going to be happening. You're going to have a second. It's just going to be Michelob Ultra.
You're not supposed to mention the Michelob Ultra on air.
Oh. All right, let's get that toast to Edgar Martinez.
New Hall of Famer, Martinez.
When we recorded last week, because of the fact that we had to record a little early.
The Michelob Ultra.
Yeah, there you go. It was still the eve of the announcement of the Hall of Fame class of 2019 for Major League Baseball, and we were a little bit nervous about whether Edgar Martinez would get over the bar despite the strong early returns. Yeah. Oh, we had appropriate fear. We didn't need it, though. Edgar got 85.4% of the vote, crushing the necessary 75% to become the second player to go into the Hall of Fame as a Mariner, joining Ken Griffey Jr.
Wow.
They've had other players who played for them who are in the Hall of Fame. Goose Gossage, of course.
Mm-hmm. That's the first one that comes to mind for
Ricky
me.
Henderson. Wait, Goose Gossage isn't even in the Hall of Fame, is he?
Randy Johnson is a notable one.
I never heard of him. I was really looking for like players who like Gaylord Perry. That's a good one. Like who meaninglessly finished out their career with the Mariners, but are not associated with them whatsoever.
Well, didn't Adrian Beltre also go to the Hall of Fame?
Just retired, so no. He's inevitably going to the Hall of Fame, but he is not there yet. Going to take a few years.
Any notable Edgar memories that are not the double or him hitting a grand slam ALDS?
I mean, you know what I would say about Edgar is, despite those two memories, what stands out about Edgar is not any specific game or moment so much as his like consistent day in and day out excellence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot easier when you don't play defense.
Is it though?
No, yes, it is, but no.
Historically, players hit worse when they DH than when they play the field, don't they?
Really?
I think that's true. I'm not going to bother to look that up and see if that's accurate or not.
It is kind of amazing how few specific memories we have of Edgar Martinez moments.
I mean, it's also probably to some extent a baseball thing, but like, yeah, Griffey, there's a lot of memories of because he made all these amazing highlights. Like Edgar, it's just him hitting. So, you know, they don't stand out the same way.
There probably are some that we're not thinking of, but I mean, those are the two where I'm like, that was an Edgar Martinez moment. And granted, he had the hit in the most important play in Mariners baseball history.
Yes. You can't take that away from him.
It's a pretty notable one.
It's just the grand slam off John Wetland is also extremely high in the most important moments in Mariners history. It's just that after that, there's probably a pretty big drop to whatever the third best Edgar Martinez moment is, whatever that might be. It might be the It's a Light Bat commercial.
Didn't he say Gooey Duck?
That also checks out. That sounds like a Mariners commercial.
It was because of Edgar Martinez that I learned how to spell and or pronounce Gooey Duck.
Well, there you go.
So it's really just a game changer.
Educational.
In the Hall of Fame, taught me how to pronounce Gooey Duck.
Okay. There is such a thing as a designated hitter penalty, I should say.
Designated hitter penalty?
Yeah. Like, oh. Where players hit worse is designated hitter.
You did look it up. You couldn't help yourself.
Oh, no, of course. Come on. You know who I am.
Anyway, congrats to Edgar. This is a moment that we waited a long time for, 10 years. I mean, he definitely...
He waited a lot longer for it than we did, I feel
speaking
like.
Speaking of a designated hitter penalty, he paid a designated hitter penalty because strictly as a batter, he's probably a first or second ballot Hall of Famer. And somebody who had to wait much longer, but getting in on this last ballot kept kind of increasing and increasing and increasing his percentage until kind of people really recognize that now is the time to get Edgar into the Hall.
And it's kind of fitting when you look at Edgar's career, how late it was that he debuted in the major leagues and then becoming a regular player, you know, not until, you know, his mid to late 20s.
He did also play until he's well into his 40s.
That was probably not a designated hitter penalty there. But it's kind of fitting that, you know, his book was entitled Patience Pays, like his kid's book. And here it worked again for Edgar.
All right.
So well, there you go.
Congrats to Edgar. Another great moment in Mariners history.
You know what?
They're going to be celebrating this all year long. They're going to have seven or eight Edgar Martinez Hall of Fame celebrations.
That's probably true. You know where else patience pay doesn't? You know where patience doesn't pay? I was going to say.
Where's that?
I was talking about ramen because we should get to that right now.
There we go.
It is time for matchup number two in our ramen bracket, and to help us. As third Pelton brother, we welcome in Stephen Wynn. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. What's up?
Stephen, so excited to have you here and help us decide the second round winner of Seattle's ramen bracket. We have both on Capitol Hill. We have Oink, the number two seed, versus the number seven seed, Suica. Stephen, you know the drill. Can you start us off by telling us your ramen credentials?
Okay, so ramen credentials, I put a lot of thought into this, and, well, I don't have a lot. So I had about 35 years of eating noodle soup, okay, so there's one. But it's mostly related to pho and Vietnamese noodle soup related, though, but I do enjoy my ramen. And two, I went to Japan for 2 weeks or a week and a half in November, so out of like the 10 days he spent there, I think I ate ramen about 7 times. So
that's a good ratio. Back,
yeah, I think it's a good ratio. Thinking back on it, probably enough, not enough ramen though, but definitely enough to like get a taste and like experience like the different like types of ramen soup. So.
Well, it's kind of amazing. It's become like real credential. The famous cousin Katie needs to go to Japan like right now.
You guys need to book flights right now. That's what you guys need to do. So it is the off season though.
It's the ramen. Oh yeah. Yeah. We've got some time to dip over to Japan.
Main season. Yeah, exactly.
It's the ramen on season.
Yeah, exactly. On season for the ramen though. So sure.
How would you, these two restaurants that you went to this week, how would you rate them as compared to the ramen that you had in Japan?
Well, that's a good question. Me and my fiance went to Japan, and we went to like three cities, went to Osaka, Kyoto, and Tokyo, and all the ramen there were much different. There we had like this I forget the name, but I think it's called there's a place in Kyoto which is outside of Tokyo called Gojo. I think it's Gogyo, and they had this burnt ramen there, and it was probably the best thing I've ever eaten in my life though. So nothing's going to compare to that.
Can you please describe to us fully what burnt ramen is?
Burnt ramen. It sounds not awesome though, but it was incredible. Basically, they take like a traditional miso ramen broth and then they light it on fire, and so you see it's like a huge visual display, and so you get this like charred bits of pork lard in the ramen, so it looks completely black, kind of like the black ramen we had like in at Oink, but it's unbelievable, like the texture and the smoky richness of the broth. It's unbelievable though. Wow. So you should go there ASAP. So
it's like a flaming mo ramen.
That was literally you can feel the heat from the kitchen from like how many times they're lighting the ramen on fire though. So it's pretty incredible.
Nice. All right, should we get into this week's matchup?
Let's do it.
Let's start out with the number 2 seed, Oink. What did you think of that?
I ordered the spicy Katori ramen. Is that what you guys got?
No, we went with, we went with the shoyu, I believe.
Shoyu, okay. Yeah, so mine was like a black garlic oil type of ramen, and it had like this malas spice. It's like I think Oink, it's a non-traditional ramen place, as you probably guys know, right? So it's like a Chinese-Japanese mashup. So
we don't know any of these things. Please tell us more.
Okay. Yeah, so like so they put like this mala sauce into the spice, and it's like this have you guys had like Chinese hot pot before?
No.
You guys know what hot pot is by chance?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like Asian fondue without the cheese. So so they have like this spicy style hot pot where they have put the spice like causes like a numbing sensation. Mm-hmm. So like it makes it like your like tongue and your lips kind of like tingling. So not my favorite type of spice though, but I do like spicy food, so I went with that. I think you can get like a 4 out of 4 stars. I went with a 1 star. And I thought it was pretty good, but my fiance, she got the same thing without the spice, and actually I think I like that better because you can actually taste like the pork broth. So but yeah, I thought it was pretty good. The noodles were like pretty chewy and springy, and like I had garlic chips on mine. I didn't know. Do you guys have garlic chips in yours?
No.
I mean, ours, I feel like, was a very traditional ramen in a lot of ways with the shoyu. I mean,
is that right? Okay.
I mean, honestly, the thing that it reminded me the most of was the Dombo ramen that we had the week before. Where the sauce wasn't overly spicy. It was rich and flavorful, but there wasn't the same kind of like kick to it that you're describing, which maybe I would have preferred a little bit more spice in it. The noodles, I think, were perfectly cooked the exact right amount, and even more so than Donbo, like the exact right amount of like soft and firmness at the same time. And then the larger pieces of pork belly in there.
Yeah, the slices of pork that I had were excellent too as well. So, yeah, so But definitely my ramen was not traditional in any sense of the word. So,
yeah, that makes an interesting comparison. I mean, and one of the reasons why, you know, it is probably best to go to these places multiple times. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily realistic from a time standpoint for this.
Well,
bracket.
At least one of these we won't be going to a second time.
That
ever.
Yeah, we'll never go there again. My ratings is we discussed last week. I've broken it down into the broth, noodles, and chashu, pork belly, individually. I gave Oink a 9 out of 10 on the broth. Generally okay. Agreed with Tristan that it was just the right amount of kick. An 8 out of 10 on the noodles, which you know is the same score that I gave Donbo, and a 4 out of 10 on the pork belly, which I thought was fine but kind of small.
Was
okay. My takeaway.
Interesting. Is your rating similar?
I didn't rate the things individually, but I feel like so far, not to give anything away here, it's probably my favorite ramen that we've had out of the 4 locations that we've been to so far. I think maybe even more so than Donbo. We're going to be going back to some of these locations, and I'm curious to kind of mix it up a little bit. We've been trying to go with basically the most plain, most basic ramen that they have on the menu, kind of as an
introductory.
Not necessarily.
I mean, I think just whatever they're best at.
Kind of like the signature dish.
Yeah.
But I'm also curious to kind of mix it up a little bit. And at Donbo, where you're able to customize quite a bit, anything that you're doing. At Oink, clearly, like, things that are so far outside of the box that we haven't had anything anywhere near so far in this ramen bracket.
I don't know if I would quite agree with that, but we'll get to that in a second.
But I thought it was a very nice overall package.
I mean, I also scored it higher than Danbo. I gave it a 90 as an overall score as opposed to 8 compared to 88 for Danbo.
Wow. Okay, and what about Suika, which is more of kind of an overall Japanese restaurant and less specifically just a ramen restaurant?
Well, there were not a lot of ramen options at the restaurant, though. When I went, I only had 2. We had the Hell's Ramen with a Z, and then the Spicy Miso.
Yep.
And then I only got the Hell's Ramen. I think I saw on your Instagram post you got the same. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, we had one of each, basically.
Yeah, we split the 2 bowls. Just posted the photo of the Hell's Ramen because they looked almost identical, so it really
wasn't. Yeah, I was going to say, do they taste the same? Because I was thinking they would probably taste the same with all the spice in it, right?
So. They did not taste the same, I don't think.
They did not taste the same.
They tasted similar, but not the same.
There was some commonality. They also, the other thing they had when we were there on the fresh sheet, their daily menu, they had also an oxtail broth, but this time with oxtail meat, as opposed to the Hell's Ramen is an oxtail broth, but it comes with ground pork.
Right. So I got that. And honestly, I couldn't distinguish the oxtail broth because it was so effing spicy. So
yeah. Yeah. That I think is fair. Like you could tell a difference between the miso broth and the Hell's broth, but not necessarily that, you know, it was flavored with oxtail.
Right. So, I mean, I thought that, you know, for a non-ramen restaurant, I thought the ramen was okay. The noodles were good. I did like the kick to it, but I think it was a little bit too spicy for my liking. What's your thoughts on ground pork in ramen?
It was bad. I mean, that just in this bowl, a lot of it fell to the bottom. So, like, you'd have a couple of bites while you're eating the ramen where you're getting some ground pork, but then you're kind of just scooping a lot of it out with the spoon when you get to the very, very bottom or grabbing it with chopsticks.
I actually like it.
Don't you like the... Oh, go ahead, KP.
I mean, I feel like, you know, you're having to, like, carefully divide up the pork belly to, like, eat it over the course of the meal, unless you're just going to go right for it at the beginning or save it for the end or something like that. Whereas the pork, ground pork, you were having it in a little bit in every, I was going to say bite, but really you're slurping up the broth is where you're getting it. And I liked that better, honestly.
I'm on KP's camp. I was going to say the same thing. It's like, at least you can like ration it out a little bit based off your liking though. But I do agree at the end, there's like a ton of ground pork left over. So yeah. I must have not rationed it as well as I probably should have. So.
It was impossible
yeah,
to.
Yeah, no, I think that was
gravity.
Yeah. But I also feel like with the ground pork, do you feel like you're getting as much value for your money too as well? I don't know.
Yeah, tough to say on that one. I mean, it really,
Kevin said right when we got it that it was the ramen that we've had that reminded him the most of Top Ramen. And this was, it was the meat that reminded me the most of, like, you know, microwave ramen bowl meat in a lot of ways. It just didn't feel fresh to me in any way.
I don't know that I agree with that at all. What did you think of the Hell's Ramen relative to the spicy miso, Tristan?
I like the Hell's Ramen quite a bit more. Just that extra kick to it, where I feel like the broth at the location, the Hell's Ramen, was maybe my favorite that we've had so far. And I might need to be getting just a little bit spicier at the places that we're going, because it did, it had a lot of flavor to it, like you were mentioning. It was like there was a kick to every single bite.
I also quite like the broth. I think it's interesting. So you started out with the Hell's Ramen. I started out with the spicy miso. And I think both of us liked the one we had first. And I don't know if that's partially just because of the fact that...
It's when you're hungriest.
You're hungriest and it's warmest. That's when it's going to be at its peak in terms of quality. But I really liked, and this is why I thought it was interesting what Stephen was saying about the options at Oink, is I really liked the garlic oil and what that added to the broth of the spicy miso, which wasn't a part of the broth of the oxtail, Hell's. So I scored this a 9 out of 10 on broth. I think even with Danbo is the highest score. I give it a 9 out of 10 on the noodles, which I liked that they were a little thicker, but still pretty soft. That's, I think, hitting my sweet spot. It's the highest score I've given out for noodles so far. And then a 6 out of 10 in which technically the chashu category, but in this case, just generally referring to whatever the meat is, and an overall score, a 92 for the spicy miso.
Wow.
The highest I've given out so far.
Wow.
Okay. Where did you rate on this overall, Stephen?
The types of ramen, the Hell's Ramen and the spicy Katori ramen, they tasted pretty similar. I did have the ramens like back to back, but like a Saturday and Sunday. And so I did kind of recall that they did taste pretty similar. Like the spice is a little different just because of they didn't have like the numbing spice in the Hell's Ramen, but they both were pretty spicy. And they're both like non-traditional in the sense that they were so spicy. And so I really thought they were pretty close, but I think I enjoyed the ramen at Oink better. But I did like the dining experience and food overall at Suica, just in comparison though. So,
well, it kind of sounds like Kevin, if you want to do your official vote on what you're picking,
I'm picking Suica.
Steven?
Oh, myself? Yeah. I'm going to pick Oink myself.
Wow. Whew. It's a lot of pressure here. I mean, to me, just the overall package and the value and the care of the ramen that went into it, Suica really just wasn't comparable to Oink for me. I mean, the Oink package, I know that there's more you can go back for, right? I enjoyed being there kind of every single bite that I was having. In the Suica ramen, I don't even know what they were, if they were like shoots or something that was in it, but there's still a lot of stuff in the broth, right? Like there are this like stringy vegetable things that were in it where I'm like, what is this? What am I pulling out of my mouth right now? Right? It was a very busy ramen that was happening. With the crumbled meatballs were really present. It just felt like it was good and I enjoyed eating it because it's ramen. But this to me so far is the worst ramen that I've had. And I have to go with, and advancing to the second round of the ramen bracket, I have to go with Oink here.
I mean, I think I'm ultimately excited about that because I want to go back to Oink and try what Steven had and see how that compares. I think like you mentioned, the overall dining experience, I want to go back to Suica and just like have happy hour there. Their drink specials were quite good. You know, not necessarily be tied to just having ramen, but I would want ramen as part of my experience. I thought it was is good enough, and I mean, obviously, I thought it was very competitive.
So, did you guys eat anything but ramen when you guys went to those places, though? Do you guys have the fried chicken at Oink, though?
No,
we were going back to back on ramen.
Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
we did Oink. You gotta get the Malaysian fried chicken. It's probably the best fried chicken I had in Seattle. It's amazing. So.
This is like when we did the dumpling bracket last year and Dozone won not because of dumplings.
I mean,
the best fried chicken you've had in Seattle.
Steven did make that reference actually about Suica.
I did. I mentioned the KP, yeah. So I think it used to be Brothers and Sisters, is that what it's called? The Hot Chicken down in South Seattle.
Brothers, yeah.
Yeah, Sisters and Brothers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, it's better. The crunch, the moist ratio is excellent. So
this is now a fried chicken bracket.
It's not a fried chicken bracket. That'll come someday. That's coming. Don't worry about it.
Oh my God. Well, I was excited to go back to Oink already, but finding out that there's maybe the best fried chicken in Seattle there, it's like, this is a game changer.
Do you guys have a wait in line too as well?
No, there was nobody there when we went, actually. It was weird because we went to Oink and there was, I mean, it was mostly empty. We sat right down. And then we went to Betsu Tenjin and there was a wait of like 45 minutes.
Whew. Because that meant there were three people in front of us. It wasn't quite that bad, but it was close.
There were a lot of people from the EDM show at Numo's who walked over there.
All right. Well, cool, guys.
Steven, thank you so much for joining us. When we have that fried chicken, we're going to let you know if it's the best fried chicken in Seattle. I am so excited about this dip.
All right. I'll be pleasantly listening. Okay, guys? Keep up the good work.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks. Whew. Well, that was our first semi-heated battle of the ramen bracket. Hopefully not
are
the
we,
last.
Are we heated?
I mean, not like angry, but like it was competitive. It was a 2-1. It wasn't a sweep. I think we're going to go out of seed order next week because I think for my schedule, it works out slightly better if next week we do the 4-5 matchup of Tsukishinbo versus Aloha Ramen.
So if you're eating along with us, those are the places to go. For next week on the ramen bracket.
Nobody has posted, by the way, that they're eating along
Nobody's
with us.
Eating I don't, along with us.
I mean,
there's only like four people who can get into these restaurants at a time.
That is a fair point. That is a fair point.
It would be very difficult to eat along with us, but your number one rated ramen ahead of Ramen Danbo goes down.
You win some, you lose some. Look, history will judge me fondly on voting for Loretta's. Should we talk about the NBA?
Let's just be clear here. Suica is not the Loretta's of this bracket.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying history is going to judge me fondly for that one. So maybe it will here as well.
Okay.
Let's talk about the NBA. And let's talk about a team that is not going to Seattle. That's the Phoenix Suns, who we talked about last month after negotiations. I guess they didn't really break down, but the vote was delayed on $150 million in public funding for a renovation of Talking Stick Resort Arena, which you'll recall is the name of the arena where the Suns play, and not an arena located at Talking Stick Resort Casino.
Where's Talking Stick Resort Casino?
I don't know specifically, but it's got to be somewhere in the general Phoenix vicinity. So subsequently, over the following month, there were some concessions made by the Suns. They committed to spend $10 million on community benefits, including $2.6 million on the city's preschool program this year, which will allow Phoenix to give teachers mandated raises and not have to lay off their preschool any of their preschool teachers. The Suns' rent will increase
The Suns are paying for this?
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, they still got $150 million.
But it's just like, why don't you just put it in... What?
The
logic of it doesn't really make any sense to me. Why... You would be like, the Suns need to pay this so that we can give them $150 million. Politics are weird.
Politics are weird.
We'll get there.
Rent will increase $1.5 million, which will go to homeless issues in Phoenix. And then of the additional city revenues generated by the arena, 80% will go to city public safety costs. And apparently these concessions were enough to convince the city council to approve this funding. And so therefore, the Suns will sign a new lease that will keep them in Phoenix through at least 2037 with an option to extend through 2042.
What does an additional city revenue mean?
I'm not exactly sure what that entails, but something related to what they derive from the lease.
Well, I mean, again, congrats to the people of Phoenix for maintaining the Suns, getting this deal done. It was another situation where, because of what happened in Seattle, they were able to use Seattle as leverage in the situation. I mean, you mentioned owner Robert Sarver, is that?
Yes.
Owner Robert Sarver basically floating the idea of moving the team, mentioning it.
Maybe not even needing to.
He didn't mention a specific city, but he floated the idea of moving the team. And that kind of got the wheels moving. They made some concessions, sure, but that kind of got the wheels moving on getting public money for this arena. And it's something that we've kind of seen over and over and over again in these arena conversations with cities post Seattle.
Yes. I mean, the other aspect of this is, you know, Phoenix is a large city. It's maybe on the small side to support four major pro sports franchises. We'll see how well, you know, Seattle will do with four if you count the Sounders. But
they don't have soccer in Phoenix.
No, not MLS.
Players would die.
I mean, it's not like they don't have MLS teams in warm weather places.
Man.
But not in Phoenix now. I mean, and it's a team that's been there since, you know, 1968, I think over 50 years. So, I mean, that is by definition over 50 years. So there's a long history in Phoenix. It would have been brutal for the Suns to move, given all of these factors.
And they're not really the type of team that we were, I don't want to say cheering for somebody to move, but the Suns
have... We're not cheering for anybody to move. We're cheering for the Seattle to get a team back.
Yes.
We're cheering for expansion.
But Phoenix is not that type of franchise, right? They seem to have a pretty solid fan base. They have a long, rich history of basketball. You know, they had kind of two decades of being pretty good consecutively in Phoenix.
Yep.
Have had superstar players that have been through there, kind of made their mark on Phoenix. This wasn't the team that we wanted.
I mean, we're not picking and choosing teams, but it wasn't a team that realistically should have moved.
you're giving me a strange look. Do you want to talk about this now, or do you want to wait until after we talk about...
Let's talk about this now.
Okay, so news today in the NBA. There's kind of been some news with a couple of franchises that we're sort of monitoring as teams that could possibly be looking to move. But the big news in the NBA of the day, if you hadn't heard, Anthony Davis requested a trade from the New Orleans Pelicans.
I've only done 4.5 hours of podcasts about it so far.
But you haven't done any podcasting about what that means for the city of Seattle.
I have not done so now.
So my question for you is, what does that mean for the city of Seattle?
I mean, obviously the Pelicans are a team with a limited fan base relative to many other NBA teams. They're a low revenue team. And if you were having a tough time getting fans to games with Anthony Davis on the roster, it presumably does become more difficult once he is no longer on the roster.
What is their lease like in New Orleans?
I don't know a lot about the lease situation in New Orleans, but I don't think it's ironclad.
Okay. So they're a team that we should continue monitoring.
Yes. And so that's a team that was and remains jointly owned with the New Orleans Saints, who have always kind of been the priority there. They're the bigger draw in the market and the higher revenue team. And, you know, the team that was owned much longer by the late Tom Benson. And then after his death last year, those teams passed to his widow, Gail Benson, who's now running the teams.
When the Saints are the signature sports franchise of the city of New Orleans.
100%.
I mean, they're the team. And it's a one-sport city, right? Or two-sport city.
Yes.
Right? This matters. I mean, you know, I was listening to a podcast with you talking with Brian Windhorst about the Pelicans are just going to be chasing another player as good as Anthony Davis once Anthony Davis is gone.
That's the Hoop Collective with Brian Windhorst. Check it out. Subscribe, rate, review.
Oh, God. Nobody ever says subscribe, rate, review about the Pelton cast.
No.
The chances in this Western Conference, which has been, I mean, how long has it been the dominant conference? 2 decades, basically?
Yes.
For 2 decades has been the dominant conference with 10 to 12 very well-run teams in it. The chances that this Pelicans, owned by Gail Benson, run by Dell Demps, are going to be a competitive team in the Western Conference, even with Anthony Davis, were slim. Without Anthony Davis, it is going to be a long time before this is a competitive team. And the only thing that will make them a popular franchise in the city of New Orleans is consistent winning at a very high level.
Yep.
What about Memphis, which is another situation that we've been monitoring?
Yeah, that's probably one we've been monitoring more closely because their lease has been in the news. And of course, there was the situation with a buy-sell offer last year, which resulted in Robert Pera increasing his controlling interest in the team instead of selling the team to minority owners who, you know, may have potentially looked to move it. The situation there is we've also then it's not a trade request, as we saw with Anthony Davis. It's quite the opposite. Marc Gasol and Mike Conley would like to continue playing for the Grizzlies, have expressed as much to Robert Pera when they met recently. But with that team falling out of playoff contention, with Gasol potentially becoming a free agent at the end of this year, he has a player option. And the ages of Gasol and Conley, there was a report last week by Woj, who also broke the Anthony Davis news, of course, that the Grizzlies are looking to move one or both of those players before the deadline.
So the Grizzlies, another, and again, Memphis, they're the only team in Memphis.
Yes.
Except for Penny Hardaway's Memphis Tigers. Another very small market.
We don't need to make a joke about whether the Memphis Tigers are professional or not, given that they have the number one player in the country coming there.
Wait, really?
Yeah, he played for Penny on his AAU team.
Oh, nice.
He's a Memphian.
A Memphian?
That's the word.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Wow. Memphis, another team where you're talking the situation. I mean, these Western Conference teams, granted, these are Western Conference teams who are very far east, but Western Conference teams who are not able to compete with kind of the power of the West, right? I mean, you look at Anthony Davis, there's a chance that he's going to be going to the Lakers, where there's going to be even more kind of weight going further to the Western Conference team. You have very well-run teams like Utah, like Portland, like Denver, teams that are built on relatively young players, deep teams, even the Clippers, who are a deep, youngish team. Right? Memphis can't compete with this. And that's why if they were in the East, they'd be in the playoffs right now.
Yeah, probably.
But they're a franchise where to really be able to turn around the franchise, they need some extreme amount of luck, or they have to try to extremely bottom out and build up from the bottom up.
I mean, this definitely feels like the end of an era. And it was a very well-defined era and a very popular era in Memphis with the grit and grind and with Gasol and Conley as the two, you know, centerpieces and constants in that era. The good news for the Grizzlies is that they have a really promising rookie in Jaren Jackson Jr. So they're not starting from scratch, even if they trade both of these players. But, you know, it probably is going to be a few years before they're competitive again in the Western Conference. And similar situation, I mean, the Memphis fan base has been much more devoted, much more loyal, has had more reason to come out than the fans in New Orleans. But that's still a low revenue team, one of the smaller markets in the NBA. And again, if you've struggled financially when you've been a good competitive team, what that looks like when you go through a rebuilding period is tough to say.
So what is the deal with Memphis's lease right now?
I mean, it's a few years away before they have an out to potentially get out of their lease. And there are a number of clauses. Local owners would have the option to match any offer for the team if Pera was to sell. I can't remember off the top of my head. Pera may himself be prevented from moving the team. He might have to sell it to someone else who would move it.
How many years are we talking?
I believe it's like 2021.
So not that long.
Yeah, it's coming up.
Because somehow we're in the future.
And that would require Pera to sell the team.
So it would require Robert Pera to sell the team. But also, I mean, if it opens up to local buyers, right? We're talking about a $2+ billion price tag, probably.
Probably if you're going to move it, yeah.
If you were a potential Seattle owner who wanted to move that, or another city, right? Let's say that you're Seattle, Las Vegas, someplace like that, and you wanted to move this team to one of those places, the price tag is going to be $2 billion plus.
And there's no way realistically that local owners could compete with that and have it make sense financially.
Well, I mean, that's kind of, I like the idea of there being a team in Memphis. It's kind of one of the unique things about the NBA. Also, this is a team that started in the Northwest.
Yes.
Like, they have a history of being in the Northwest and moved from there to Memphis. It doesn't really feel like if the team were to move to whatever city, particularly to the Northwest, they wouldn't be robbed in the same sort of way.
I mean, it would still be extremely painful, but yes.
I mean, to me, New Orleans is the city that makes the most sense, partially just because there hasn't been that much of a fan base there. It's just, it's not the type of city that can support an NBA franchise.
Even if they were very successful, I think it would be tough for a franchise in that market.
So do you think that the NBA, when they're weighing expansion, since we're having this conversation, are they waiting out? I mean, how many things are they waiting out before they really start talking expansion?
Well, supposedly the new TV deal. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's an element where if you, you know, I think there's a lot. We've talked about this in the past, and my colleague Brian Windhorst has written about it, that owners have the feeling like we're paying so much in terms of revenue sharing to some of these smaller markets. If we can turn those smaller markets into larger ones that would actually pay into the revenue sharing, that's a better outcome for us than expanding and giving up, splitting up the national TV pie an additional two ways.
But when does that happen? I mean, it's just to me like, how long? When is the new TV deal up?
I think it ends in 2024. I mean, the negotiations would be before then.
2024?
Yes.
There's going to be a light rail station to Queen Anne by then.
Not quite then.
Oh my God. I mean, I suppose it makes sense on behalf of the owners looking at it in that way, but Jesus Christ. I know that people talked about this with LA and NFL relocation for a long time, but do you think that there's some sort of element of the NBA liking having Seattle out there as an open market?
2025, by the way, is the end of those TV deals.
I'm going to be 50 years old in 2025.
That math does not check out.
If I know anything about math, I'm going to be 63 years old.
No, that one does, that does check out weirdly.
Are you kidding me? I can't wait that long.
I mean, that's for expansion. Obviously, the timetable could be sooner if it is, in fact, relocation. I think the NBA, I mean, it's certainly useful to have leverage in terms of an open market, but I don't think the NBA needs Seattle to do that. There's always going to be markets.
There's more cities. I mean, look, the NFL has two teams in LA and still has leverage. The NFL is doing just fine.
Yeah, there.
Anyway, it's interesting to consider. You know, to me, when I look at New Orleans, they've shown no interest necessarily in having any sort of like process-like rebuild. But also, I just don't know if there's a fan base in New Orleans to get behind that process in the same sort of way.
It would be a tougher sell for sure.
Speaking of relocation.
Yeah. The person who is in part responsible for the Sonics moving in the news. You may have seen that Howard Schultz loves this country and is exploring an independent bid for president. In conjunction with that, he released an autobiography on Monday and discussed the Sonics moving in there. He expressed a lot of regret and said he would do things differently in hindsight. Concluded by saying, "The sharpest pains hit me not when I'm publicly insulted, but when I'm walking or driving and see someone wearing a Sonics t-shirt or cap. If it's a boy with his dad, it's like a stake through my heart. Losing the Sonics has been tragic for generations of fans, especially kids who are growing up without the benefit of an NBA team in their city. It's a public wound I cannot heal. For that, I will forever be deeply sorry."
Apology accepted. You know, if you can have a public apology come and as a couple of paragraphs in a book, I mean, that's like the most sincere possible way to do it. Oh, when you're running for president.
Exploring a run for president. You know, forgiveness is important to me.
Oh, my God.
And it's something I've had to pursue with a number of people involved with the Sonics move.
I thought you were going to say a number of people in this room.
Well, I mean, yes.
Wait until Katie's here next week.
I'm still not sure I've forgiven you for the time you hid Madden 95 and it was lost for like 5 years before we discovered
it. Madden 96.
It was probably Madden 96, yes. It was in 1995.
I remember playing with Tishmunga Biakabatuga.
Still haven't forgiven you for that one. I mean, here's the thing is like some people I know saw Matt Calkins wrote in the Seattle Times that, you know, this made things worse. I just think sometimes people confuse or like conflate the apology with the act itself. There's nothing Howard Schultz could say or do at this point, short of bringing back the NBA to Seattle, that would make anyone feel better about it. So I guess I would probably rather him take some responsibility and apologize than be completely silent on the matter, as he has been for the last 11 years.
Why now, though? I can't believe you're actually out here defending Howard Schultz.
Oh, I mean, first off, you should know better than, you should know to believe that by now. I mean, obviously the reason he's doing it now is in conjunction with this bid and the autobiography.
It's not even we were talking, maybe it's because we haven't seen the full excerpt or whatever. Everything that I've seen quoted is like two paragraphs.
Well, I mean,
you lost a team with 40 years of history to one of the most important cities of the country. You made it so that, for me personally, you lost your job because of it. For me personally, 40 nights a year were affected by this. There's almost no way that almost anybody else could affect my life that much, right?
I mean, I'm sure there are some ways.
As far as random billionaires go, though, right? Like, this is a ridiculous thing to just have two paragraphs and be like, hey, sorry about that.
I believe the Seattle Times story said there were 5 or 6 pages.
Okay,
like that.
Well, that changes everything. Like, this needed to happen years ago, happening right now in conjunction with an exploratory presidential bid, is just like, it's like a slap in the face. It's like, hey, I know that you're going to be angry at me for this city of Seattle. By the way, I'm sorry. Like, who out there told him? Did he go public with the story, right? Because this wasn't people who read this book. This was a story that was pitched from a publicist.
I think the Seattle Times was given an advance copy of the autobiography and generated the story from that.
And so all the other stories have been because of that Seattle Times piece?
I mean, other people probably got advance copies, but that's the first I saw.
The Sonics thing. There's somebody who intentionally thought that this would be a good look out there. And I would say that the internet and Sonics fans in general have widely come together. Did you see the tweet from, I think it was William Cornell, where it was like all the different factions of people banding together? It was like In-N-Out fans and Dick's fans, Oregon fans and Husky fans, right? All the different people gathering together. Oh, Running Backs Matter Twitter and Analytics Twitter gathering together, and in the middle, all their hands gathered, and that is what this has done, right? This apology,
that's not what this has done. That's what the Sonics moving has done. That's what I'm saying.
Just say nothing at this point. You missed the window, right? If you're Howard Schultz, what he could have done is he could have come out 5 years ago, right? Because how many years has it been since this move?
10 and a half.
10 and a half years.
But who's counting?
He could have come out 5 years ago and been like, you know what? I really fucked up. Like, this is something that I am guilty about all the time. But when it happens in this book, you're like, you're running for president. Like, it is so obvious what's happening here. I
mean, do you think that Howard Schultz doesn't honestly feel bad about it?
Do I think that Howard Schultz doesn't feel bad about it? I really don't think he cares.
I
think he feels bad about it in as much as the negative publicity really hurts him. But the most important point here is that Howard Schultz didn't only betray the city of Seattle with this sale. He made a bad business decision. This team would have been worth upwards of $1.5 billion if he had just waited 10 years. 10 years. And he's saying the thing that he should have done instead is waited until he found a local owner. Maybe you should have had some vision whatsoever for what was happening. He should have understood the scarcity of sports franchises because other people did.
Not that many people did at that point. But yes, it was a bad business decision.
He lost himself about $1 billion.
I mean, he lost the group about $1 billion. He didn't own
even
that high
worse,
a percentage.
The people who should be most angry at him are the rest of the group. Like, it was just, but all of this.
Howard Schultz did not have the ability to push the sale through on his own. Let's be clear about that.
He made a colossally bad decision by selling the team when he did. He got basically the lowest market value for the team that he possibly could have gotten. And He colossally misjudged the situation. If he honestly, which A, I do not believe this was the situation, thought that selling the team to a group from Oklahoma City would get the local politicians to start moving, right? I mean, because that's basically what he's saying.
No, I believe that he believes that.
It was a colossal misjudgment of the situation. When the story came out the day the team was sold, the story was, this team is moving to Oklahoma City. How could he not have seen that? I remember exactly where I was in my bedroom in one of Grandma and Grandpa's old green velvet chairs, sitting there reading the story and being like, and I was just like, it can't happen. And it was like, Sonic sold to group from Oklahoma City. There's like talk of moving or whatever. And I was like, this can't actually happen. But that was instantly what people thought of. Everybody but Howard Schultz saw this. And then the team moved. It didn't take them a 2021 timeline. It didn't take them 2025 after light rail to Queen Anne's Bay.
Actually,
they moved within a year.
No, that's not true. It did take them a 2021 timeline. It took 2 years. That's how long 2021 is from now. I don't know if you know what year it is. Felt guest mad.
But there's no Seattle owner who's bought a team in New Orleans.
That is accurate.
Because people now are smarter because of how stupid Howard Schultz was, if he is being honest. He's either A, liar, or B, incredibly stupid. There's no way that you can look at the situation and say that Howard Schultz made a good decision or a calculated decision.
Well, that was a fun conversation. Should we talk about the team that is coming to Seattle now?
I don't know what of the conversation is actually happening, but yeah.
Emily Kaplan of ESPN.com had a great feature last week about NHL Seattle in advance of last Saturday's NHL All-Star Game. A few key takeaways from the piece. The NHL Seattle group is launching a fan portal to solicit feedback. They added 5,000 people to the waitlist after the expansion announcement, with just 4 deposit cancellations after the news that the team would be coming in 2021 and not 2020.
Four people?
That's what they said. 4 people. Those 4 people were like, I can't wait. I need the hockey in 2020.
People who got hockey cold feet.
they went and bought Thunderbird season tickets. I'm not exactly sure when this happened, but Gary Bettman has promised that Seattle will host an All-Star game within 7 years of the arena opening, which is actually shockingly long time, 7 years, I would say. Also, Todd Leiwicki said the team is hoping to host the 2021 NHL draft, which would be ahead of the team's first season.
Host it?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, they move it around like the NFL draft. And then a quote from Leiwicki: the name at the end of the day rests with David Bonderman, who's the majority owner. We're gathering input, but sometimes fans also want to be led. There might be some names that haven't been out there because we're marshaling really powerful thought leaders on this.
I was with you on all of the other things until this. I was with you for the All-Star game and the draft. Powerful thought leaders. What does that mean? They're marshaling powerful thought leaders to figure out whether Sock Eyes is a great name or not. The answer is it is.
Do you think thought leaders are similar to influencers?
Yes. Influencers. That's what happens at the
Steve owns the team
fuck
now?
Jerry stockholder meeting. influencers. Oh my God.
Well. Mariners news. The Mariners acquired a player. They made a trade. Believe it or not, Jerry DePoto had been like literally weeks.
He came out of the hospital and was like, yeah. Trades.
They acquired prospect second baseman Shed Long in a 3-team trade. From the Reds, sending center field prospect Josh Stowers to the Yankees. Long was considered a top 10 prospect in the Reds organization and kind of seems like rebalances the Mariners farm system a little bit better, since they had a number of outfield prospects apparently and not enough in the infield.
There you go.
So there you go.
And you get to make a number of get off the shed jokes in the coming years.
For example, if the Reds, when they traded him, they got off the shed. Get off the shed. The Sounders.
You don't want to hear me talk about Howard Schultz, but you're totally fine with this content.
The The Sounders have begun training camp. They spent a few days at the training facility in Tukwila before at Starfire in Tukwila before heading down to California to train in better weather. After the first day of practice, GM Garth Lagerwey confirmed extensions for Jordan Morris and Christian Roldan, who got the start for the USMNT last night as they beat Panama in an exhibition 3-0. The most interesting thing to happen so far is rumors of a possible transfer involving Nuhu, who unbeknownst to us was at the start of January named a top 10 January window transfer target by The Guardian.
What does that mean? The English football is interested in Nuhu?
Probably more likely France, but yes.
Because he's French.
Well, he's not actually French, but he's from a French-speaking country.
Senegalese or something?
I believe he's Cameroonian.
Okay.
The Guardian listed a hypothetical transfer price of $5 million for Nuhu. So
wow!
He's like on the come up.
He's like really barely able to crack the starting lineup with the Sounders.
Yes. And that may be a factor in it that they have Brad Smith, who they acquired last year on loan, but missed an extended period due to injury back on the team this year. And if you did get a transfer fee of that size, it might allow you to make the Brad Smith loan permanent.
Interesting.
So
it'd be very fascinating if Nuhu ended up playing in, League One?
Yep.
I'm assuming here that he probably would not go directly there. You'd probably need a little bit of time to develop in League Two, per se.
One would think.
But that is very fascinating. I mean, he wasn't somebody who you could see there was some raw talent there, but he wasn't somebody who I think we said to ourselves in the way, who's the left back that they had?
You're talking about DeAndre Yedlin?
Yeah, Yedlin was somebody who was playing in the World Cup for the U.S. And you could see it was only a matter of time before this person was playing kind of in European football. You're looking skeptical.
I suppose so. I mean, it's a little easier to play for the USMNT than it probably is for the Cameroon team.
But still, I'm saying that looking at Yedlin, even as a Sounder, he looked like an impactful player. Knew who at times makes some big plays, but as somebody who's still kind of, he needed a lot more coaching.
Yeah, but I think we saw a bit of a breakthrough from him in the second half of last season, and clearly the scouts elsewhere saw that as well.
I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm all for basically any Sounders transferring and finding opportunities at other places.
Yeah, especially if the Sounders can put that money towards bringing in new players.
$5 million. Wow.
I'm not 100% sure how that works. I don't know if they get the full $5 million, and I think they get.
You're gonna have to look at conversion rates.
It was £5 million technically. Yes, that is a fair
That's
point.
That's actually more than $5 million.
Yeah. The Pro Bowl was last Sunday. I hear you watched some of it. Mm-hmm. The NFC lost to the AFC 26-7. We're heartbroken. Russell Wilson went 5 of 8 for 68 yards as the starting quarterback for the NFC. Was sacked 4 times, which helped contribute to a number of 3 and outs, which the upside meant Michael Dixon got a lot of work. 4 punts for 173 yards in a game in which the AFC did not punt. And then Bobby Wagner is the other Seahawks representative, had 5 tackles.
Who is the punter for the AFC?
I don't know, because he wasn't listed in the box score. So
wow.
I have no idea.
You know what? Russ is just out there doing Michael Dixon a favor.
Russ was a lot more accurate before he was touched by any rain, as he was on Sunday, in the Pro Bowl Skills Challenge, where he won the precision passing competition.
Do you know that Bobby Wagner tried to jump over the line on an extra point in the Pro Bowl?
Okay. I did see the video of that on Twitter. I mean, he jumped. He did that part of it. He got called for a penalty, and the field goal was made. But
I didn't see a good replay of whether he touched anybody.
I think it was just that he went over the center, which is not legal, I believe.
Do you think Pete Carroll is excited about that? Because you're either competing or not, or he's like, this was just needless.
That's a good question. I don't have a good answer.
This is needless risk to be doing this in the Pro Bowl. Russell Wilson, I thought there was one drive where he played pretty well, but then after that, I mean, you don't actually get sacked in the Pro Bowl per se. The quarterbacks kind of just get touched.
Are we playing a drinking game every time you say per se now?
Am I saying that often?
I think so.
All right. He looked pretty good, all things considered, considering that Russell Wilson was touched by rain.
Yeah.
He didn't look that bad. And then things kind of got ugly. Then it looked like Russell Wilson was touched by rain.
I mean, I have no idea what actually happened on these plays where he was sacked. Is I did not watch the Pro Bowl.
I mean, he's not like working to escape the plays because it's the Pro Bowl, but he definitely missed some throws. Dixon looked great though.
All right, well, that's what really matters.
Yeah.
I instead on Sunday afternoon was watching the UW women's basketball team host number 5 Oregon, a game that they were competitive in but lost 76-57 after getting crushed 86-39 by number 9 Oregon State on Friday.
Wow.
That is a score.
Were you at that one?
I was not at that one, thankfully. Of all the scores, that is one of them. The Huskies dropped to 1-7 in Pac-12 play. Is a promising non-conference start has gone by the wayside, I would say, a little bit. This weekend, UW will head to LA to face the LA schools on Friday night at USC, which comes in 1-7 in conference play. And on Sunday, they'll be facing USC, which is rebuilding a little bit after losing from last year's Elite Eight team. Jordan Canada, who ended up playing for the Storm, was their first round pick last year. And then also Monique Billings, who is also a WNBA selection playing in Atlanta. And UCLA without the two of them at 4-4 this year after winning in triple overtime against Arizona and former Storm player Adia Barnes last Sunday.
Nice. This is like the one Pac-12 women's road trip where one of the teams isn't in the top 5.
Yes. There's more than one, but this is...
I mean, just the level of competition in the Pac-12 is pretty insane.
I mean, I was thinking of the number of games the Huskies have played against top 10 teams because these two... They played, I think they already played at the Oregon schools. No, maybe not. But at Stanford, and then they hosted Mississippi State. So they've played a lot of top 10 teams. We wrap up with UW men's basketball, which got the sweep of the Oregon schools. Apparently just the second time since, like, I forget what they cited on the broadcast, 2012-13, that a team has swept the Oregon schools on that road trip.
Oh, really? I thought you were going to say the Huskies, and I was like, that's actually pretty good. But
I mean, it's the second time this year they've swept a road trip. They already did it at Utah and Colorado.
Anybody?
Yeah.
Arizona when they were good? UCLA when they were good?
I mean, Oregon has generally been very good and especially very difficult to beat at Matt Knight Arena. But the Huskies got a 61-56 win there on Thursday in a wild finish, a game where they led pretty much throughout, led by double digits in the first half. Oregon came all the way back to take the lead with the Huskies struggling against their full court pressure. But then in a tie game with 19 seconds left, Oregon had the ball. Peyton Pritchard, their veteran point guard, turns it over. Jalen Noel heads the other direction, pulls up from about 40 feet, probably pulled up too early when you actually look at the time left on the clock, but Pritchard inexplicably contests the shot, and there wasn't a lot of contact, but maybe grazed him. I had no idea
this happened. This is the first time hearing of this.
You didn't know this happened?
No, I was out there coaching.
They have Twitter. They have replays, highlights. Got a 3-shot foul with 1.6 seconds left.
That's how we got those points?
Yeah, Jalen Noel hit all 3 free throws. Oregon subsequently threw away the ensuing inbounds pass, and UW was forced.
Is it Kevin Pritchard's son?
No.
Oh, okay.
UW was forced to inbound the ball, and therefore got 2 more free throws to produce the 5-point final. They won by 5 points in a game that they were trailing with they were tied with 4 seconds left, and did not have possession at that point.
Oh man.
So that was a pretty incredible outcome. Saturday's game at Oregon State, a lot less dramatic. The Huskies led by double figures pretty much throughout the second half. Beavs made a bit of a late surge, but got no closer than the 79-69 final as the Huskies ran their record to 7-0 in conference play. The last time they started 7-0 in conference play, 1952-53.
Wow!
The only year that the Huskies have reached the Final Four. And you know what that means?
What does that mean?
Nothing. That does not mean anything.
I thought we were making bold predictions
here. No, we are not making that bold prediction. They are up to 35th in the KenPom rankings, their highest since December.
They were 33rd for a while, weren't they?
Were they? I don't know. I didn't see that. Highest ranking since December 2014, which was also the last time they won this many games in a row. They started that season 11-0 behind Robert Upshaw.
Oh, God.
went south in a hurry. KenPom currently projecting a 15-3 conference record for the Huskies, which would tie the most conference wins in school history and is 4 wins more than anyone else is projected for in the Pac-12 right now by KenPom.
Everything about this makes me so scared.
It should. Huskies are not, as we discussed last week, we mused that if they swept, they would have a chance to be ranked. Alas, no, they finished 3rd among teams also receiving votes in the Associated Press poll, 7th among that group from the coaches poll, which, why the coaches be hating?
Good question. We only recognize the AP poll here at the Politicast today.
We would be more likely to recognize that poll if the Huskies were ranked. I heard
28th
you had some,
isn't bad. I'm not.
I thought you had some takes about this.
They were joking takes. I'm really not that upset about being 28th because you look at the KenPom ratings and record wise, you're like, wow, this team's 16-4. They seem like they're doing very well. But then you look at all the other teams near the bottom of the poll and it's like basically everybody has this record.
Yeah, and also those teams are playing in real conferences.
The Huskies are undefeated in this fake conference.
I mean, look, they're doing everything they can do against their terrible competition in this terrible conference.
The thing that people should really be looking at is not that they're 16-4 or undefeated against all these garbage teams. It's that they were so close to winning some of these other games that would have mattered.
It's true.
Like, the difference between winning and losing really is just so negligible. They should be looking at how close they were to beating Gonzaga. Right?
Yeah.
And how close
they
basically beat Minnesota.
Well,
right?
if they basically beat Minnesota, they would have beat Minnesota. They very easily could have beat Minnesota, and their record would look a lot better if so.
You, of all people, should know that winning and losing barely matters. What really matters is playing close in these games and blowing people out, and that's what they did against Oregon State.
It was the most impressive performance to me of the pack of the season for the Huskies.
The entire season.
Yes.
It was one of those games where we were talking through the first half, and they got up relatively big sort of early, and it was just, you see all these points. Like, we've seen this 100 times before, both with Husky basketball and in college basketball in general, where it's like early lead, you're like, okay, they're going to, Oregon State's going to close the first half and be down 10. And it's like, they didn't quite do that. The Huskies didn't quite finish the half as terribly as maybe they have in the past. And then to start the second half, it was like, okay, Oregon State's going to have the run in the second half, and then it's going to be a close game, and they'll go back and forth. They'll end
up
being
tied. And then Stevie Thompson will hit a three.
They'll be tied with like 7 minutes left. We've seen this. We saw it last year.
Saw it in Oregon.
Stephen Thompson, and he still kind of terrorized the Huskies in this game. It just didn't matter.
No.
And that's something that we haven't seen. Them being able to extend this lead and get it to the 20-plus that it was at in the second half, it's like, oh, this game's actually kind of over with 7 minutes left, is something that it's been a very long time since we've experienced this. And it was an impressive closing to the game for this team.
I don't know if it was an impressive closing. Oregon State did make a bit of a run.
The game was over at that point.
The biggest drama at that point, I believe that was FS1. The broadcast was, or no, that was Pac-12. Broadcast very concerned with whether the Huskies were going to extend their streak of not having allowed 70 points in conference play, which
they didn't.
They did extend the streak. I was more concerned with the victory than that streak myself.
But getting a little bit of luck in Oregon on Thursday, whatever. I mean, they still were in the position to win that game. It's not like they got, you know, this wasn't LA Rams level luck. They were tied. Like, the game might have gone to overtime, or Jalen Noel might have hit that shot had he not been fouled, that I have not seen or heard about until this very moment.
Pulled up from 40 feet. With a lot of time left on the clock, as it turned out.
I heard he's money from 40 feet.
Steph Curry hit one of those today. He was not fouled.
But this was the kind of road trip where you look at it, and again, I'm so fearful for saying these words, and you say, this is the kind of road trip that you need to sweep to be an NCAA tournament team. And the Huskies went out and did it.
Yeah.
Because I always think, like, of the teams, I'm sure this is not mathematically supported, of the teams in, like, 20 through 25, both football and basketball, the most likely outcome for you the next week is unranked. Because once you get into that range, it means that you won a game that you probably shouldn't have won, or you happen to have a bunch of games at home, and then you're going to go on the road and lose. And that's not the situation for the Huskies right now. They went and won two games on the road, and now they're coming home with two winnable games this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, two not gimme, neither of them are gimmies, but winnable games. So on Wednesday, they will host USC on FS1 at 8 p.m. The Trojans went 7-6 in non-conference play. Four of those six losses came to teams in the KenPom top 25. They have won three in a row at home since getting swept on the Oregon trip. They were not one of those teams to the other team that swept at Oregon.
Assuming it wasn't this year.
No.
It's probably a good team.
They have played the second easiest Pac-12 schedule thus far after UW, but also second in defensive rating in conference play behind the Huskies and third in net rating in conference play behind the Huskies and Utah. USC opponents are making a conference low 45% of their two-point attempts in conference play. This is a team that really relies on their front court. They've got senior Benny Boatwright and junior Nick Rakosevic. Rakosevic is an efficient post player who's making 66% of his twos in conference play, and Boatwright, who's healthy after
missing... been around forever.
I mean, you know, most seniors, it feels that way. He's healthy after missing time last year and is hitting 43% of his threes in conference play while also providing some nice rim protection for a power forward. You'll recall that USC signed a pair of Seattleites this year. Rainier Beach product Kevin Porter, who is a probable one-and-done, an NBA prospect, hasn't really been a big factor since coming back from a quadriceps contusion that sidelined him at the end of non-conference play and the start of conference play. He also missed their loss at Oregon due to a one-game suspension for, quote, personal conduct issues. And Garfield product Jerron Brooks is getting regular minutes off the bench.
Huh. And both of them go to USC?
Yeah. Huh. Along with Shaquan Aaron, who's still there, but hasn't really had the kind of career that people expected from him as when he was a standout coming out of Rainier Beach.
Poison to begin the Game of Thrones. The reference means nothing to you.
I have no idea.
Is this the toughest game that they're going to be playing this weekend?
No, I would say that UCLA is probably slightly tougher. I mean, it's difficult to say exactly how good they're going to be or what they're going to get from Kevin Porter because he just, you know, has been so up and down. He had, you know, a really good effort for them in their win at home against Arizona, had 14 points in 18 minutes, and then he's played 10 minutes against Arizona State and did not score.
Wow.
So it's all over the map.
I mean, it feels like the Huskies this year have been able to kind of shut down star players a little bit.
This will be an interesting test. I mean, Boatwright is the kind of player that they haven't necessarily faced a ton of in terms of a big guy who can shoot the ball, maybe shoot over some of the perimeter players in the zone who aren't Matisse Thybulle. Like, if you've got David Crisp closing out on him, that's not going to be necessarily a favorable matchup for the Huskies. And I think Rakosevic can certainly have some success in the paint on the offensive glass, which, you know, has predictably been a weakness of the zone.
Okay, so then what about the tougher game that they play on Saturday against UCLA?
Yeah, the slightly tougher. I mean, UCLA has annually a really difficult schedule in non-conference, probably too difficult at this point. It's like the Huskies in the late stages of the Tyrone Willingham era when they were wildly overscheduled. They went 7-6 with
John Wooden didn't exist.
I mean, yes. It's been a long time.
The pedigree of UCLA, the standards are a little bit different.
Okay, but John Wooden is not walking through that door. You know who is walking through the door?
Who's that?
Murray Bartow, who is the son of Gene Bartow, who replaced John Wooden.
Oh, wow.
Weird full circle thing there. They went 7-6 in non-conference play with just one win over a top 100 team, and that led to Steve Alford being fired before the start of conference play. Under Bartow, they started 3-0 in Pac-12 play, but then lost 3-0 before unexpectedly blowing out Arizona on Saturday.
It's okay. I knew that one of these teams crushed Arizona. They beat them by like 30 points.
I think 22, but who's counting?
And that was UCLA?
Yes. USC also beat them, but much more narrowly. Or I guess, actually, no, I'm sorry. USC crushed them too. They beat them by 23. What am I talking about?
Wow. Good God, Arizona's bad.
It was, well, I mean, they were playing really well. They were undefeated, or they were 5-1 in conference play before that. So, I don't know. The Pac-12
is weird. Let's just knock on wood here. Let's just all be careful.
Let's. UCLA is playing at the fastest pace in conference play under Bartow, which is kind of one of his trademarks. They're lacking shooting. They have made just 33% of their threes so far in Pac-12 play. They've benefited from the fact that opponents have hit just 30% of their threes, which is more than Husky opponents have made, but not by much. They turn the ball over a ton, perhaps predictably given the fast pace at which they play. 7'1" freshman Moses Brown is the nation's leading offensive rebounder, so he's going to be someone the Huskies are going to have to watch on the defensive glass. He's also an excellent shot blocker, as you'd expect given his size. And I think that this is going to be a game where, given that lack of shooting, the zone, which often, you know, has been really perimeter oriented under Mike Hopkins, is going to pinch down a lot to take away Brown, and then Chris Wilkes, who's, you know, a pretty good 2-point shooter, good intermediate shooter, not a great 3-point shooter, and then their point guard Jalen Hands, his ability to penetrate. He's third in the Pac-12 in assist rate, and also, you know, shoots a high percentage on twos, but not so much on threes.
Jalen Hands with the good assist rate.
Yeah.
It all makes sense.
It does.
What would you say percentage chance of winning one, both, or zero of these games are?
I would say the chance of winning both of these games is like 60%.
Really?
One is like 35 and none is like 5%.
Okay.
That'd be a pretty unlikely outcome.
So this is not the easiest pairing of teams that they'll face all year, but...
No, that's Stanford and Cal.
It's not the most difficult road trip. Or
homestand.
Homestand.
Yeah, no. I mean, they're comfortably favored in both of these games.
Okay. We can live with that.
Yeah. I mean... To have a realistic chance of getting to 9-0 in conference is pretty incredible.
I mean, both of them present kind of slightly different problems that they haven't necessarily seen this year, with kind of big men who can score, big men who can shoot is something that I don't even know what they've seen. None of these teams look like they're any good at all.
I mean, Oregon has their merits in Oregon State. Trace Tinkle's having a great year. The Huskies contained him pretty well. Shut him down is too strong, but they contained him. In recruiting news, UW commit Isaiah Stewart and one of their targets, Jaden McDaniels of Federal Way High School, were both named McDonald's All-Americans last week. McDaniels celebrated that by scoring a school record 51 points on his senior day Friday against Todd Beamer High School. He broke the record of 49 held by Donnie Marshall, who later played at UConn and in the NBA.
Donnie Marshall went to Federal Way?
Not Danielle Marshall. Marshall.
I know they okay. both.
Yeah.
One of them was on a like pregame show that I was watching.
Yeah, Donnie Marshall does work for Fox Sports now. He's quite good.
I saw him. Oh, good for him.
So Jaden McDaniels currently tops ESPN's 2020 mock draft that came out last week.
Oh, my God.
So could be very interesting to see whether the Huskies can get him. He would be their highest ranked recruit in 2 years.
He's a higher, since Michael Porter, you're saying?
Yes.
All right, fine. Michael Porter's...
I think I did see something that implied that Stewart was a higher ranked recruit than Markelle Fultz, which might be true, because like people didn't realize when Fultz was a high school senior how good he was. It wasn't until like that summer that people really figured out like, oh, this guy's amazing.
I know he was a late developing player.
Forgot how to shot. Fultz. Shoot.
What are the chances of them getting Jaden McDaniels?
I don't know how to handicap that.
When will we know?
I don't know.
What is signing day?
I mean, most players sign in the early period. If you wait, you can wait all the way up through the McDonald's game, which is early April, and then the Nike Hoop Summit right after that.
So relatively soon, though.
I mean, April.
That's soon.
Well, he's going to go to college next year. I mean... Yeah,
it'd
be weird if you waited until August.
I'm gonna get Jaden McDaniels so bad. I mean, you're talking about this team, which first off, when we're talking about the Huskies, can we shout out Sam Timmons?
He's been unexpectedly. Well, that was a strong trip for him to the Oregon schools. Can we shout out Naz Carter?
My God, some of these dunks. I mean, this team, that Oregon State game in particular, like David Crisp learning how to shoot, kind of.
It's been great throughout conference play.
David Crisp, Matisse Thybulle. I was listening to the game, to the radio broadcast, Tony Castricone on the radio broadcast.
Our third Pelton brother, Jason Hamilton.
Matisse Thybulle had like 4 steals in the first 3 minutes of that game.
That is accurate.
I mean, it's just kind of ridiculous what they're doing. Kind of everybody is performing to the best of their abilities. And then Sam Timmons is out there skying in for blocks.
They might have described it more epically on the radio broadcast. I don't remember.
Well, no, I guess I was watching.
He did have that one play, yes, where he did sky in on him for a block.
Described it.
I don't know.
All the way from the Space Needle comes Sam Timmons.
I still don't know if I would say he was skying in. Maybe flew in.
It was an athletic play by Sam Timmons.
Sam Timmons is shooting 32%. Oh, no, that's Hamir Wright. Hamir Wright is shooting 32% on threes this year. On twos this year.
Oh, twos.
18% on threes.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It looked good when he knocked one down.
I feel confident Hamir Wright shooting the three, though.
Sam Timmons is shooting a fine 61%. 33% from the free throw line, not as high.
But all of these players, I mean, Matisse playing the defense, but led by Jalen Noel, has kind of emerged as the offensive star. Are you hearing, people are wondering, any scuttle within the NBA circles that you run in about Jalen Well as an NBA prospect this year?
Yeah, Ben Miller asked this on Twitter, a tweet that was subsequently liked by Jalen Noel, and fortunately he did not like my reply that I have not heard any NBA buzz on.
If you would have responded from the Pelton Cast Twitter, 100% yes, we would have had a new listener, third Pelton brother, Jalen Noel.
But I don't want to get Jalen Noel's hopes up unrealistically. I mean, look, I'm not saying that I like talk to NBA people all the time. That would be an inaccurate description. But in the conversations that I do have with NBA people, Jalen Noel's name has not come up. And he's not in the top 100 of draft, the Draft Express ESPN Plus board at this point. So
do you think it takes,
he also wasn't in the 2020 mock draft either. So take that for what you will.
When they see him with these first round picks, when they see that Jalen Noel is the best player in the team, all of a sudden people are going to change their tune. Do you think that it takes kind of like an off season for people to reset their opinions about players?
No, not necessarily. I mean, you can change your ranking dramatically within the season.
He's playing well though, right?
He's playing slightly better than last year.
You don't think statistically that Jalen Noel is playing well?
I don't think he's playing poorly. I don't think he's playing, like, his stats in conference play are not really, I guess they're better now. No, I guess, yeah, he improved them a lot last week, and he's up to a 59% true shooting percentage. But a lot of that is based on shooting 55% on threes on 22 attempts, which I don't think is particularly sustainable.
Super sustainable.
Yep. I mean, he's shooting 49% on twos, which is up a little bit from 45% last year in conference play.
How is that
play
for an NBA prospect?
Not good.
Even for a perimeter player?
Yes. I mean,
that's outside of the top 100 shooting?
I think
it takes people, like, when that top 100, if it comes out in November of this year, right after the season is over, I think people are going to rethink Jalen Noel. I don't know if I think that he's a realistic NBA prospect this year, but he's a potential NBA prospect eventually.
Eventually.
Right, well, we hope it continues. Everything continues for the Huskies this weekend against USC and UCLA, and they can get to the best. It's unprecedented. There's no 1954 walking through that door. There's nothing better to get to. The best record ever.
I don't actually know what the 1952-1953 start team started. I don't know how. Like, they might have gone 9-0 for all I know.
Don't stop me. I'm on a roll here, Bob Briggs. Looking for the best start ever in Pac-12 play with an opponent 3-point shooting percentage that is super sustainable because it has now happened 2 years in a row. You and all of your hate cannot stop them this time.
But by the way, as John Gassaway pointed out on Twitter, the Huskies are shooting as well in conference play this year as Villanova did in conference play last year, which is an obvious sign that they're going to win the national championship.
Wow.
That team, let's see. They
seems had like history is happening.
They had an 18-game winning streak.
They only beat Oregon by like 5 points, and they're shooting as well as Villanova shot last year.
I mean, that wasn't a huge part of it. Wait, I'm confused here. This seems to imply that the 1953 team lost to UCLA in their fourth game.
So wow.
Maybe, have we been citing the wrong year? Was it actually 1953-19? No, that team was not good. Now I'm confused about this.
It really makes you think.
I'm going to have to get to the bottom of this. But that team won 18 games in a row at one point and was 21-1 in 1952-53. So Husky's not going to be able to match that start, as it turns out.
Whew. But could get to 9-0 in conference play and would be in a pretty good position at that point. Where do they rank in bracketology, by the way? I meant to ask that. Where does Joe Lenardi have them today?
They are an 8 seed, and amusingly, even though these pairings mean nothing in the bracketology, facing number 9 seed, Syracuse.
Syracuse?
Yeah.
Is Duke in the next round?
No, Michigan State would be the number 1 in that one.
We'll see. It would be fun to play Syracuse.
It would be fun to play Duke. It'd be fun to make the NCAA tournament.
Exactly. I don't care who they play. They could be in the 12 seed play-in game. I do not care. Just make the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, I care about that one. No,
that still counts.
That's not a real NCAA tournament game unless you win.
I love the idea of zone on zone, though.
Yeah. I mean, we saw a lot of that last weekend, but Syracuse zone on Syracuse zone. All right, on that note.
Whew, thanks for listening.
Thanks.